I'm Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. On Tuesday of this week, The Washington Post ran an editorial that began, "The president is about to head to his ranch for the month of August. We have what might seem like a far-fetched notion. What about a news conference?" Lo and behold, on Wednesday, President Bush met the press.
"Good morning. I was hoping it'd be a little hotter here to prepare the traveling team for the Crawford experience this August. But thank you for coming."
Once upon a not-so-distant time, the mere fact that a president took questions from reporters wouldn't have been news as much as what the president said. And the Washington Post certainly wouldn't have had to ask him in public for the privilege. But the rules on presidential press conferences have changed over the years, from Eisenhower to Nixon, Carter to Clinton, to suit the occupant of the office. And the way a president handles these occasions forms an important part of the public's image of him. We're talking this hour, Connection listeners, about presidential press conferences. Who do they serve, the president or the press? How well do they serve you? 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation. And we have a big panel today of experts to discuss the history of the presidential press conference. And with me in the studio is David Gergen, currently the director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served as an advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Clinton, and served as director of communications for President Reagan. From Fairbanks, Alaska, is Martha Joynt Kumar. She's professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland and has been studying White House communications since 1975. And also with us is Mike McCurry, former press secretary to President Bill Clinton, who's currently chairman of Grassroots Enterprise in Washington, D.C., and one up-to-the-minute expert, Dana Milbank, who is the White House correspondent for The Washington Post. But before I turn to my panel, let's just hear a bit more from the president on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. President. Building sort of on that idea, it's impossible to deny that the world is a better place, and the region certainly a better place, without Saddam Hussein. But there's a sense here in this country and a feeling around the world that the U.S. has lost credibility by building the case for Iraq upon sometimes flimsy or, some people have complained, non-existent evidence. And I'm just wondering, sir, why did you choose to take the world to war in that way?
Look, in my line of work, it's always best to produce results. And I understand that. For a while, the questions were, could you conceivably achieve a military victory in Iraq? You know, the dust storms had slowed you down. And I was a patient man because I realized that we would be successful in achieving our military objective.
Then the president continued.
And so this is going to take time. And the world will see what I mean when I say a free Iraq will help peace in the Middle East. And a free Iraq will be important for kind of changing the attitudes of the people in the Middle East. The free Iraq will show what is possible in a world that needs freedom, in a part of the world that needs freedom. Let me finish for a minute, John, please. Just getting warmed up. I'm kind of finding my feet.
Dana Milbank, did he find his feet? And does the Washington Post feel that it got what it wanted when it asked for a press conference?
Well, I suppose so. It was the editorial page that asked for it. Of course, we on the news side don't feel that we have the rights to demand anything. But the president really does not like to give these press conferences. That was his eighth. It compares to something like 33 that Clinton had given at a similar time and 60-something that the first President Bush had given at a similar point. The president believes that he's better off just taking a question or two at a time after each event, that these are moments for the network correspondents to posture and preen. They seem to have a point there, and that it seems to be better for the press than it is for the president. If you look at how this president's communications have done, he certainly has not suffered from having so few press conferences, and one could argue that they have been successful in spiking that long institution.
Do you ever learn anything of real journalistic value by getting a question to the president directly in that situation?
I have not actually succeeded at that. My colleague was at the press conference this week. The Washington Post had been passed over a few times, we believe, as a sort of punishment for our coverage. But the general view of these press conferences, they don't yield much information. Of course, whenever the president speaks at all, it's news. But he's very good at not making news that he doesn't wish to make. So to the extent that he makes news, it's information they were looking to deliver anyway, or or it possibly in a case where he said something he wasn't supposed to say or went a little too far, caused a little problem at this week's press conference by getting a bit out in front of his staff on the gay marriage issue.
So if you're not really learning anything of journalistic value, and if you're being passed over and being punished in public, I mean, why make a point about demanding them anyway? If you need to find out what the White House is thinking, I mean, aren't there other ways to get that information for your reports?
Well, there are. I mean, the complaint, as I say, it's our editorial page which is making that demand. The common complaint of reporters covering the White House is just a general lack of information coming out of this White House. Lack of press conferences is one symptom of that, but in general, it's very hard to crack through this White House and find out what's really going on there. The press conference has an obvious advantage over just taking a quick question or two every couple of days. On the question of the day, the president knows exactly what questions he's going to get. He's prepared with an answer. When you have a press conference and you're taking two dozen questions, you're going to get a lot of wide-ranging questions. Things will be phrased in different ways. The president's more likely to have to speak on his feet, and that's when you get interesting things that come out that you wouldn't get out in the more scripted scenario.
David Gergen, you've served in any number of White Houses, and you were the Director of Communications for Ronald Reagan. Now, as an extremely interested private citizen, what do you think of the president's performance, first of all, but also the overall view of the White House that direct engagement with the press is not a priority?
The president proved once again in this press conference this week that anytime any president takes a microphone in front of the press, you have the upper hand. This president was able to sail through this press conference and laugh and joke his way through it and show a lot of confidence just before he went on vacation in ways that I think helped to shore him up after a slide this summer in his credibility and in his approval ratings. I happen to be a strong, strong advocate of regular press conferences, and we can go into that in a bit, because I think that they are essential to our political culture. And even in this press conference, Dana Milbank had a fascinating story today in the Washington Post about the administration embracing a new rationale in the Middle East for why we're in Iraq, that the president's press conference gave him, helped to lead him into that story. The president said some things by implication in the press conference, which Dana and another reporter at the Post were able to follow up with an administration's official yesterday. They had a fascinating story today, and we learned something from that.
Dana, tell us a bit about that story while we're here.
Oh, it was... you could see when the president was asked a question about the weapons of mass destruction, it was the question you just played. It was CBS's John Roberts asking about that. The president responded by rephrasing the question. He said the real question is, are we going to have a peaceful Iraq? And then he went on to discuss the strategic importance of having a peaceful and democratic Iraq transforming the Middle East. So quite literally, he took one question and answered it with a completely different question. Add that together with other echoes that you've heard, and a senior official we're not allowed to identify, fill that in a bit more for us. So I think David is right. You get the chance to, every time the president speaks, even when it's a stump speech, you can find out where his thoughts are going. But particularly when it's an unpredictable thing like a press conference, you are more likely to get him off of his regular stump routine and really get into his thinking a bit more. And I think David's right. That is a good example.
You've covered this White House. I think you also covered the Clinton White House for a bit. What is your impression about the differences in the way the press operations work?
I came to cover the Clinton White House after the Monica Lewinsky scandal had broken, so they were pretty much in a hunkered-down mode at that point. All White Houses, I believe, start out with a notion that they can control the press, that they will be different, that they will not leak, that they will get the news covered the way they want it to be covered. I think this White House has been extraordinarily successful at that. In fact, it's only in the last month or two that we've seen a bit of a break. breakdown in that with the problems of the failure to find the weapons, questions about whether intelligence was exaggerated. So certainly this White House has been far more effective than the Clinton White House and pretty much anybody previous to that in modern times in controlling the message. So as much as I think having a regular press conference is serves democracy well, it is quite conceivable it does not serve at least this president well.
I'd like to bring into the conversation Martha Kumar, who's professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland, but she's actually in Alaska at the moment. Hello, Martha.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Now, you've heard what we've been talking about here. Could you tell us a bit about the broad stroke of your study? Because you've been studying the actual interactions, press conferences in a variety of different ways of presidents going back to Lyndon Johnson.
Oh, yeah. And earlier as well, in the period before press conferences were on the record. At one time, presidents had very regular press conferences, but they also were off-the-record events, so they could control what was released out of those press conferences. From Eisenhower forward, they have been on the record. But presidents say at Eisenhower's time, Eisenhower had 193 press conferences, as did President Clinton. But Eisenhower had no interviews with reporters and had no short question and answer sessions, which Clinton had. And if you look at the number of interactions, counting up the question and answer sessions, the 193 press conferences and the interviews, Clinton had 1,603 interactions with reporters, times when he answered questions of reporters. So presidents over the years have found other ways to communicate that were less higher risk than press conferences. And, of course, the president's staff doesn't want to put him at risk. They want to give him a setting that he is comfortable with, and where he is not going to make errors. Now, some presidents have enjoyed press conferences a great deal. In Kennedy's case, it was a forum that worked very well for him. And in Clinton's, too, in prior to the Monica Lewinsky scandal, in December of 1997, he had a press conference at the State Department, which went, I guess, about 94 minutes. And in it, you could get the range of his thinking, get a good sense of what his brand of leadership was and how much he knew about policy and what his interests and priorities were. And when he was questioned down deep into a policy issue, what he knew. Okay. And so it was something that worked well for him.
Martha, I'm going to stop you right there. We're coming to the end of the segment, and I know, Dana, you actually have to go to work and get reporting for tomorrow's paper. But since the president hasn't been calling on you, let me call on you. What is the question you would have asked at Wednesday's press conference if they had allowed you to ask it?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think the problem was often that by the time they get back to the newspapers, the questions have been pretty well picked over. So I think John Roberts was on the right track with the weapons of mass destruction question. The question I would have been prepared to ask at that point was saying a majority of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein had a role in the September 11th terrorist attacks. I just would sort of an essay question. Why, Mr. President, do you believe that is the case, and do you believe your administration encouraged that belief? To get him on something he didn't expect.
Dana, thanks very much for joining us. And
thank you.
That would have been a great question to put to the guy, and I'd love to have heard his answer. Thank you very much. Back to work. Connection listeners, in this hour, we're talking about presidential press conferences. The conversation is inspired by their infrequency in the current Bush administration. His father had no problem with that. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call. Ask a question of David Gergen. Next segment, Mike McCurry. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour, listeners, about presidential press conferences, the history of them, the changing rules on how often the president is expected. And there is no hard and fast rule, is there, David Gergen? It's not codified in law that the president has to meet the press. He only has to report from time to time to the Congress of the United States about the State of the Union, right?
It's certainly not codified in any law, but it is codified by tradition. Let's go back to fundamentals here and what's going on. In the formation of a democratic government, formation of our form of republic. We the people gave certain powers to the government. In exchange for that, we ask of them accountability. We want to know how they're using the power that we give to them. The press conference is just like the State of the Union. It's a way to account for power. Franklin Roosevelt really introduced the modern press conference. He held 2 a week throughout 12 years of very difficult, challenging time, and was regularly accountable, and by the way, served the public extremely well. The press conference is not for the press. It is not for the president. It's for the public. It is a way for the president to speak to the public through the press. In a parliamentary system, the prime minister is held accountable by the parliament. The prime minister has to go into parliament on a regular, weekly basis to take questions to account for how he or she is using power. We do not have a parliamentary system. The substitute in our system is for the president to appear before the press and ask those questions that the press, in effect representing the people, can put to the president. And if you don't have press conferences on a regular basis, you don't have accountability. The people don't get the information to which they're entitled. We are entitled as citizens to understand not only what decisions the president and administration are making, but why they're making them. It's why we ask of the Supreme Court, when you issue a decision, you have to issue an opinion that goes with the decision. You can't simply issue a decree. You have to explain the rationale for what you're doing so that people understand how the Supreme Court is exercising power. In the same way, we look to press conferences, we have traditionally looked to press conferences, as a way for people to explain how they're using this enormous power. And when we see a decline of the press conferences, it is a decline of political culture. It's a decline of a democratic culture. And that's why they're so vital. And yes, we all play games about whether it helps the president or it helps the press on a particular question. But there is something very fundamental at the foundation of the whole idea of a press conference.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now Mike McCurry, who was former President Bill Clinton's press secretary for the majority of his term. Mike McCurry, you just heard David Gergen rather eloquently explaining the precise reason for press conferences. But your man, according to my other guest, Martha Kumar, actually interacted with the press more than 1,600 times. Was it always motivated by the reasons that David Gergen was suggesting should have motivated, or did President Clinton have other reasons for wanting to deal with the press so often?
Well, David Gergen, customarily eloquent, sketched out a good reason why press conferences are good for the American people. Let me argue that it's also good for the presidency, and I'll borrow an argument from New York Times columnist William Safire, who I think is right on the money on this point. Press conferences within government are action-forcing events to prepare a president of the United States to face all the myriad questions at a press conference. It means you have to have concrete, specific answers on a wide range of policies. Now, very often bureaucracies produce nothing but mush for those who stand up and answer questions from the press. And if the president is there and is given a very mushy answer prepared by his staff, he's likely to ask for some more clarity amongst his policymakers. I found that very often the case. Bill Clinton one time in preparation for a press conference said, well, that's not an answer, that's an equivocation. And someone shot back to him, oh, you have an equivocation when you don't have a policy. So I would argue that for the institution of the presidency itself, these regular encounters with those who hold a president accountable are very useful because they get the processes of government unstuck. Now, as to Gergen's point that there's no equivalent to what in a parliamentary system would be question time, I've always thought it would be a delicious possibility to have the President of the United States go up to the House of Representatives and face something approximating a question time on a regular basis, I suppose.
Well, Mike, you know, I live in London, and many is the time during the mid-90s when John Major was the Prime Minister, a far less articulate man than Tony Blair, when you would hear Labour Party, you would hear people saying that, God, I wish we had a Bill, I wish Major could be like Clinton, man. Because, you know, the Conservative Party was aware that the guy could not communicate on his feet, although he was certainly an intelligent man and in small groups exceptionally articulate. It was just that when he got up on the big occasion, he became utterly tongue-tied. So now we've got the other situation, I suppose, where I suppose that the 8 Democrats running for president all wish that they had Tony Blair's ability to think on his feet. And you know, Blair takes questions once a month for an hour at least from the press, and it always ends with him looking around saying, "Don't you guys have any more?"
Well, I think they also would all like that bully pulpit at the White House, too, to articulate a case. I mean, it's a unique platform from which you can make an argument about America's future, and it's always a surprise to me that presidents don't want to take that opportunity. I think David Gergen is right. Even amidst scandal, presidents, when they face difficult moments, can rise to that challenge and present themselves in something of a new light for the American people.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Greg is calling from Gaston, Florida.
Gaston, Florida. Yeah. I also want to ask Mrs. Toomer, is it, from
Kumar,
Alaska?
Mrs. Kumar.
I'm sorry. Of those, if you deducted the Monica Lewinsky scandal from President Clinton's interaction with the press, we're probably still over 1,000. Could you possibly include in your study how many manpower hours on his staff that cost the taxpayers? Because I think really my issue is that this is about the people, and I think that we should move towards a quarterly interaction with the press and the president so that we know. I don't think that the American people could, if we had the president act like a CEO and give us quarterly updates, I think that's more informative and it's more productive, more than having daily addresses where you have some 5 staff members that have to prepare for the president. There may be issues regarding security issues, issues regarding law that may come up, that bills are being passed, and information that's not relevant, and we're spending too much time talking about talking rather than running the country. And
I would disagree. I think it's very important, even on a regular basis, with those short question and answer sessions where Clinton had just over 1,000 of them. They're very important each week that the president be on the record on providing information on his thinking on policy. That is an action-forcing mechanism within the White House that daily the White House has to keep up with what's going on in the bureaucracy, and so that they are on top of events. It is important for the president to be able to explain his policy, and once every quarter would certainly not be sufficient.
Well, David, you worked as communications director for a time in the Reagan White House, and I've got some statistics gathered by Martha Kumar in front of me. President Reagan held 46 solo press conferences. None of these joint conferences where he was perhaps signing something into law with somebody else watching and he didn't take questions. How much time went into your preparation with him for these press conferences?
Well, the caller was right. It does take time for the staff to help a president prepare. Mike McCurry has gone through this numerous times. The normal drill is that a staff prepares a set of potential questions from the press and then has a set of suggested answers or points or facts that the president might draw upon in preparation. The president sits down and tries to read that briefing book, and then there's a mock press conference just before, and frequently Bill Clinton would do this over lunch, or you go into the theater, the family theater, and prepare them. So there is a time of preparation. Richard Nixon used to hole up for 3 days in preparing for that because it was such a big event for him, and he didn't like the press, and I think psychologically difficult for him. But let me go back and underscore Mike McCurry's point, which I think is fundamental. It's not only important for the public that the president be accountable, but it does help a great deal inside. Some 20 years ago, in the Reagan administration, the president sent troops into Lebanon in order to calm things down there with the Syrians and the Lebanese and the Israelis and that sort of thing. But then we left those troops posted there, and they were out in barracks out near the airport in Beirut. Now, at that time, we were holding very infrequent press conferences, and too rare within the Reagan administration. And after they'd been there the troops had been there 3 or 4 months, we had this a terrorist attack, and 257 Marines died in those barracks. And then eventually we withdrew the troops. I believe, and I think Jim Baker, who was chief of staff, believes that had we had regular press conferences, weekly press conferences of the type Martha Kumar is talking about, that the president would rapidly have come to the point of understanding there was no rationale for leaving those troops sitting out there by the airport, that there was that it was a bureaucratic, it was a mistake just to leave people in place. And we had never sort of seriously questioned ourselves hard within the administration about what the heck are they doing out there and when are we going to bring them home. Now, I think it might have produced a change in policy had we had regular press conferences. I think that happens frequently in government.
Now, we actually have some tape of President Reagan. It's not, as you will hear, an official press conference, but it's an event that took place when he was having the annual photo opportunity just before Thanksgiving Day and presenting the White House turkey for photographers.
Mr. President, who's going to head that commission investigating what happened?
Did you ask a question?
Mr. President, what did you know about money going to the Contras?
All I know is this is just going to taste wonderful, and I'm looking forward to tomorrow. He's not looking forward.
Mr. President, how much trouble are you in because of this Contra revelation?
Did you know about the Contras, sir?
When would you be able to speak out on this Contra business? Mr. President, you've never ducked tough questions before.
Mr. President, hasn't this damaged your presidency?
David Gergen is smiling. Mike, you're probably smiling, too, when you hear Sam Donaldson yelling like that.
And Andrea Mitchell, they're both inimitable.
That unmistakable voice. I'll tell you this, though. When a press corps is not getting the opportunity to answer questions like that, any event, including the annual pardoning of the turkey, becomes open game.
For the turkey, too, right?
For the turkey, too, right.
Yeah. But it does bring up a very interesting point. I mean, we heard the press conference earlier in the program from the day before yesterday, and the press sounded awfully respectful of President Bush, who hardly ever speaks to them. And, you know, Ronald Reagan was an affable fellow and also had a good press, but by this point in his presidency, they were incredibly aggressive. Why do you think, David, that the press is, I guess, more polite? Some of my listeners will say cowed, but more polite towards a president who simply avoids them, as opposed to Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, around and about.
Some of your listeners might be right.
You mean cowed?
It's hard to know. There are swings in the moods of the press. All of us who are on the line here today remember the almost animalistic quality of questioning during the Nixon period, especially after Watergate. The kind of questions that were thrown at Ron Ziegler and then at President Nixon during that time were just fierce. And then it calmed down under President Ford, with President Carter. There was a calmness in the beginning, and it became fierce over time. By the time his presidency was over, you know, Jody Powell, the press secretary, said that if it rained in Washington, the press would blame it on Carter. And so you have these cycles, and President Reagan, for a while, there was a deferential quality, and in fact, a book was written on bended knee, talking about the relationship of the press to President Reagan. But after the Iran-Contra scandal broke, there was this outcry from the press and a natural desire to get to the bottom of it. So I think it comes and goes. Right now, we're in a cycle that ever since September 11th, the press has been, in my judgment, in the presence of President Bush, extremely respectful to the point of being deferential.
Martha Kumar, in your studies of presidential press conferences and interaction, have you been able to quantify the kind of cycle that David Gergen has just been describing? Do you think that cyclical experience is backed up?
Well, a president generally has more press conferences in the earlier part of his administration than the latter part. They like them a lot more at the beginning, when the kinds of questions reporters are asking tend to be ones about the president's goals, his appointments, and stories that are going to be positive stories. The time when they don't want to hold press conferences are when they're in trouble. And so at that time, any kind of a public event like the turkey pardon or the president getting on a helicopter, reporters are going to yell questions. And that was true in the Clinton administration on the Monica Lewinsky issue. Sam Donaldson was yelling questions then as well, when the president would come out, make an appearance, and not take questions. So when reporters have questions to ask, they're going to present them in one form or another.
Mike McCurry, did you feel that you were on the receiving end of the wrong side of the cycle that David Gergen's just been describing?
Well, you know, the role of the press secretary is a little different. We're the designated pinata for the press corps, so they just get to whack away at us all the time.
I once saw you at work in Paris when the president was signing the Dayton Peace Agreement, and believe me, you were whacking the press corps. You can't tell me that.
Well, you're right. It's probably a little mutual, and you're there as a surrogate. But you know, there is a difference in the culture and the way the two political parties deal with the press. I think Democrats, by and large, have a more freewheeling experience handling a press corps, and they're more likely to believe at the first instance that the press is an ally, sticking up for the little guy, being on the side of, you know, speaking truth to power, that sort of thing. Well, I think Republicans don't have any illusions of that, and they come in thinking that they're going to be much more taught and disciplined in managing their message and getting it out through the press.
We're coming to the end of the segment, and I just want to quickly throw that point about a party difference to Martha Kumar. Is that true?
Yes, very much so. In Republican administrations, they tend to be coordinated at the top, and communications and planning is what they focus on, and the press office becomes one element in an overall communications and persuasion operation. In a Democratic administration, you tend to have more interest in answering questions on a daily basis and trying to be responsive to reporters, and as Mike says, trying to develop a good relationship, feeling that a good relationship is ultimately going to bring you good publicity. The Republicans, though, have the view that they don't care about the tension in the relationship. What they want is product, and what they want to be able to get their message out their way and on a continuing basis.
Martha, we're coming to the end of the segment. I want to thank you for joining us all the way from Alaska on the phone. Thank you very much. Connection listeners, we're talking in this hour about presidential press conferences, the history of presidential press conferences, particularly in the modern era. Do you feel that you're well served when the press gets to ask the president a question directly? Would you like more press conferences from President Bush? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation with my guests, David Gergen and Mike McCurry, men who have a lot of experience on this. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking about presidential press conferences in this hour. Connection listeners, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Will is calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Hello. I'm interested in your panelists' opinion regarding some phenomena that I seem to appreciate over the years as the press conferences have evolved. Certainly the press is deferential and courteous to the president, but overall I think the climate of respect for the presidential office has declined in this country. And the second thing is that the manner in which questions are delivered seems to have evolved from a straightforward question to now a statement of fact or supposed fact followed by a question, forcing the president to either rephrase the fact or, you know, if the initial statement is ignored, it sort of goes on record as fact in some people's minds. And that seems to be a more recent phenomenon.
All right. Let me put that question to David Gergen.
Well, the caller's right. There was a period of time from about the beginning of FDR's presidency right up through the mid-60s when the presidency seemed to be a highly successful institution. The country government was succeeding. People believed in government as an instrument of change and of not only facing a depression but winning a war. And the presidents were treated with enormous respect from, you know, so that reporters, for example, never disclosed that Franklin Roosevelt couldn't walk, and there was this grand illusion that was everybody engaged in Washington, and right up through I think think John F. Kennedy into the Lyndon Johnson period. And then Vietnam and Watergate, of course, changed everything. And we've had a series of incidents since then in which Meg Greenfield once said, if we in the press are cynical, we have much to be cynical about. And we've seen a decline in respect for the president illustrated in the press. But just as we've seen through American society in general, almost all leaders have enjoyed less respect today than they did 30 years ago, with the exception of the military. And so you see a much more raucous kind of environment can break out in these press conferences than we did before. And not only is there more cynicism, but there's this sort of gotcha form of journalism that people played with Mike McCurry, and Mike knows that, you know, that they try to catch you out, and they try to catch presidents out.
Well, Mike, you obviously, serving President Clinton, had to be on guard for all those gotcha questions, because they related to a subject that was, you know, as far off presidential policy, administration policy, as could be.
You know, I'm struck by what David says. I think it's true in the second half of the 20th century, when we thought of the president as the leader of the free world, it would actually be dangerous to put a president through, let's just say hypothetically, a sex scandal, because, you know, he was the person that we looked to lead the West against this formidable adversary that was what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire. I think that had a lot to do with the fact that reporters were generally more respectful of the institution of the presidency until the Cold War ended and questions began to be raised about how straight the government was in dealing with this. I think it's also the answer to the question, maybe, why has the press corps seemed a little cowed in front of President George Bush after September 11th? The stakes were raised again, and we suddenly did need the president to be more the person who would lead us and keep us secure and keep our family secure from terror. So I think those external things really have something to do to define the environment. Let's face it, the 1990s could give way to a silly season and Monica Lewinsky and other things, because everything else in life was reasonably secure and going along nicely.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ben is calling from Boston.
Hi. We've been mentioning the importance of presidential press conferences for democracy, American style, and the tendency of the current administration to shy away from holding press conferences. And to me, that would represent a watering down of democracy, a decreased opportunity for holding the administration accountable, providing for transparency. How concerned should we be about the decrease in presidential press conferences during the current administration?
David Gergen.
Well, I think that there are a lot of questions about whether we should be concerned about the decline of a democratic culture. You know, that Daniel Patrick Moynihan, before he died, he had an essay that captured people's attention about what's happened in general society. He called it "Defining Deviancy Down," and the whole notion was that we were much more tolerant of deviant behavior, criminal behavior, than we had been at one point, that there was a decline in the culture. And I think that to a degree, the fact that there are so few press conferences today and no one seems to care. No one seems to care all that much. You know, the Washington Post, even in that editorial calling on President Bush to hold a press conference, did it with a slight cheeky quality. It was not, you know, there wasn't an uproar from the press. There hasn't been a real lot of pressure on President Bush to hold a press conference, even though he hadn't held a formal press conference in several months. So I think that that in general, the political culture, A, is not as there have been some traditions which have eroded, and B, I think that Mike put his finger on it again about the post 9/11 environment. People are want to. You know, we're giving the president enormous latitude because we do want a strong, effective leader.
Although, in truth, David, it's slightly off the subject, but I mean, I think a lot of people felt that the press that covered candidate George Bush were already in something, if not deferential mode, because he wasn't president yet, were in some ways going easier on him than the press that was covering Al Gore.
Perhaps that's true. I don't accept that as a general proposition, I certainly don't think that George W. Bush is president today because the press was more deferential. I think Al Gore lost that election on his own without too much help from the press. President Clinton, George W. Bush, all presidents sort of experience cycles in their own relationships to the press. It tends to be There tends to be a honeymoon period in the beginning when a candidate, look at the Howard Dean phenomenon right now. There'll be a lot of press that are in love with Howard Dean right now, and they're going to, but he's going to be subjected, if he continues his rise, he's going to be subjected to some pretty harsh scrutiny before long, and he's going to get a little aggravated with it. And you tend to go through this process that Mike and I both experienced with people, and that is you start off with a period when people start to fall in love with you, and then they see all your flaws, that you have a feet of clay, and then they go after you, and they subject you to much tougher pieces, and then you reach a plateau. Everybody sort of reaches a position where, okay, you don't, the candidate doesn't particularly like them, and they don't particularly like the candidate, or they see all these flaws. But you sort of reach a modus vivendi where you're working with each other, and it's not a terrific relationship. Unfortunately, a lot of people in recent years have, and politics have reached the conclusion they don't like the press, and they simply ignore them. I mean, Alan Simpson has this famous incident when he's in the Senate, and some constituents of his bring in their daughter who's going to the Columbia Journalism School, and Senator Simpson asks the young woman, well, what are you studying to be? And she says, I'm studying to be a hunter. And he says, well, what in the world are you going to hunt when you graduate from school? And she said, people like you.
Oh, but she was a constituent from Wyoming where they hunt all the time. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. David is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia.
Hi, good morning. Listen, thank you for taking my call. I have a question, then I'll hang up and listen to the answer. It seems to me that President Bush, at his press conferences, a few that I've seen, chooses people who serve up gopher balls, or is everyone serving up gopher balls? I've heard no tough questions at all, and are these is this by design or by accident? I'll listen on the air. Thank you.
Okay, David, thank you for your call. Mike McCurry, did President Clinton sort of know in advance who was going to treat him with greater kindness than others? Did he plan these things?
Well, there's sort of a ritual pattern that you have to work your way through the major correspondents from the networks, and usually the major correspondents from the leading newspapers that cover the White House on a regular basis. And then you try to go to places, if you're calling on people, where you think you're going to get an interesting question that'll illuminate some policy that you want to talk about. It's not a science, and very few are the reporters who actually will tip their hand in advance, but my impression is that under President Bush, they are much more calculated in how they plot out and strategize who they're going to call on. I think it's and it's no secret that they avoid someone like Dana Milbank, a guest earlier on the show, because they're afraid that that would signal that they are somehow or other getting too warm or too cozy with people who have been openly critical. So I you can play some games, but quite frankly, there's a limit to how far you can go, because institutionally, the press there will sort of stand up and rise up with some degree of unanimity if you try to play too much hardball.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Dee is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, I'd like to comment on how can we force more press conferences, because we can't get information, we can't get dialogue. I mean, I'm a voter, I'm involved, and I feel as powerless as I've ever felt because there's no dialogue. I was in England this spring, and they talk about it. They, you know, contact their leaders. Their leaders have to respond. Tony Blair has to stand up and respond to questions, and we don't have that anymore, and we need the press to do that. How can we force the press to ask the harder questions?
David Gergen, what would be a strategy for citizens to get to the press?
Well, one of the things you can do is in the Democratic primaries that are coming up, you can push the candidates very hard in the citizen sessions. What is going to be your commitment in terms of press conferences, and get people on the record about, if I'm elected president, this is what I will do. I promise to have a press conference every week. That begins to raise the standard back up. It then puts, in turn, raises questions within the Bush White House. Okay, what kind of standards is President Bush going to embrace in the second term? Some years ago, I think it's almost 20 years ago now, Marvin Kalb, who was at the Kennedy School and running the Shorenstein Center and a major figure in journalism, pulled together a commission to look at presidential press conferences. I happen to be a member of that. And we issued a report saying, look, it would be, and this was in the midst of a presidential campaign before the 1980 campaign, the standard ought to be the president ought to meet the press once a week in a sit-down or half-an-hour session of some sort. And then there ought to be a regular, once a month in that case, evening event where the cable news or and the over-the-air networks can cover it if they wish, so that all citizens after work can have a chance to see the president answering questions. That's the kind of standard I think we ought to be driving for. After all, if FDR could do it twice a week during the midst of a war, it should not be too much to ask whoever is president to meet the press once a week, rain or shine. Because what happens, Michael, is that there's a real tendency inside the White House saying, oh, we don't want to put him out today because there's a bad story out there and we don't want to get him in the middle of that story. So let's do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes and there's something else you don't want to do. And you keep postponing it. It's like going to see the dentist. You try to avoid it as long as you can. And there's a tension in every White House about how often to see the press. And the people who are against doing it tend to get the upper hand because it's so much easier not to do it. It's inconvenient. It's inconvenient for a White House, but as Mike says, it really, the bottom line, helps the White House, and it's extraordinarily important for the health of democracy.
Dee, I want to thank you for your call. Mike, we're coming to the end of the hour. I just want to ask you, David sets up some ideas. They are ideals as much as ideas. How likely do you think it is that you could get to a point where you might actually, by more than custom, have the president in a public forum with the press being accountable to the American people?
I think there needs to be a barter struck between the press corps that covers the president and the institution of the presidency. I like David Gergen's borrowing Marvin Kalb's formula. That is a good, reasonable proposition. However, at a time in which we've got a 24/7 news cycle, the president really is available all the time. That's how you get Martha Kumar's amazing statistic that Clinton had more than 1,000 encounters with the press. A lot of these are sort of run-and-gun opportunities, like that little clip we heard of reporters asking questions over the gobbling turkey. I think if the press corps is willing to be less insistent on having that kind of access to the president, which is, quite frankly, tortures White Houses because they have to come up with, all the same care and precision goes into getting the answers to the questions for those short, brief photo opportunity sessions. If there could be fewer of those and less of a requirement for the president to always be on the record at those sessions, then I think most White Houses would be willing to, in exchange for that, do something like more formal press conferences once a month in a prime time hour in which all Americans can view. I think, frankly, that's better for the presidency and for most presidents anyhow. Remember, Bill Clinton early on was sort of doing morning press conferences every day after jogging and getting his coffee at McDonald's. And after a while, most Americans said, good God, enough of the president. We've seen enough. So I think measured doses of this, but the press being a little more flexible and letting the White House do its job is what's called for.
Mike McCurry, I want to thank you very much for joining us. David Gergen in the studio with me, thank you for joining us. Connection listeners, you can continue this discussion online at our website, www.theconnection.org. Our senior producer at The Connection is Tara Murphy. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.